From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. President Obama's victory wasn't the only good news for California Democrats yesterday. Voters also overwhelmingly passed Jerry Brown's tax measure, Proposition 30.
The only place in America where a state actually said, let's raise our taxes for our kids, for our schools, for our California dream.
Meanwhile, Democrats appear to gain a supermajority in both houses of the state legislature and in other closely watched measures. State voters also decided not to require labeling of genetically modified foods and to keep the death penalty. This forum hour, we turn our attention to state and local election results, and we want to hear from you. What races or measures were you closely following? Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this hour of our forum program. And in this forum hour, we want to turn our attention to local and state issues and get analysis and reaction to yesterday's election results on the local and state levels. And we've once again assembled an excellent panel of veteran analysts. With us in studio is Scott Schaefer, reporter and host of KQED's The California Report. And welcome, Scott.
Thanks, Michael.
And also with us in studio is Corey Cook, Associate Professor of Politics. He directs the Leo McCarthy Center for Public Service and the Common Good at the University of San Francisco. Welcome, Corey Cook.
Good to see you. Thank you.
Good to see you. And I'm not seeing John Myers because he's joining us by phone, but glad to have him aboard as well. Political editor now with KXTV in Sacramento, former Sacramento Bureau Chief for KQED News. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michael. Good morning.
Good morning to you. And let's begin, John, with you and, well, with what looks like a supermajority at this point and Governor Brown's tax measure passing. It might be safe to say that this state has become even more Democratic than we imagined it to be before.
Yeah, I think we still have a purple state, you know, the combination of the blue coast and the red inland, but it's an awful different shade of purple. I would say it's an awful lot more of the blue part of it, I think, today. I mean, clearly, you know, the governor did something. I think everything, actually, if we back up, Michael, everything that the Democrats are looking at today is historic. The governor did something that has not happened for the last eight times someone's tried to raise taxes on a statewide ballot, and that's that he got a tax increase. Almost, I would call a general tax increase, though it was supposedly earmarked for schools. We could talk about that. And at the same time, you're right, as you alluded to a moment ago, you look at the returns from around the state for the state legislature. It looks like the Democrats have a supermajority, two-thirds hold on seats in both houses, in the state assembly and the state senate. And for some context here, it has been the last time either party had a two-thirds majority of the whole legislature was 1933. And, of course, this raises the issue of being able to raise taxes, override gubernatorial vetoes.
Maybe have fewer initiatives.
perhaps. I mean, this is going to be, if these numbers hold, and we have to put an asterisk by them because there are a couple of races that are still pending, but if these numbers hold, it's a very fascinating dynamic for Democrats in California and a Democratic governor here in Sacramento.
Puts quite an onus on the Democrats, too. I mean, let's not forget, if they don't succeed in doing a lot more, then the Republicans can maybe bounce back to a degree. But this changes the whole landscape. And let's talk about the propositions, which change a lot of the landscape as well. It would appear at this point, let's talk first about capital punishment, the repeal of capital punishment, which was in Proposition 34. Californians, once again, want to keep their capital punishment.
Yeah, and you know, we've had capital punishment on the books since the voters put it in place in 1978 in California. It has always polled well, and that is people have supported the death penalty. In the early parts of this election cycle, Prop 34 looked like it was doing better. There were people who were really seriously considering doing away with it because of the financial cost of all of the appeals that death row inmates get. But as the race went on and as the polling went on, the measure got lower and lower, and as you said, we're about a 5-point loss at this point for Prop 34 supporters, and the death penalty would stay in place. So I will point out that the people who said who were opposed to Prop 34 have already issued a statement this morning saying, let's fix the system. It does not work well in California. Let's deal with all the death row inmates. Let's deal with the block on executions in the state. You know, let's try to fix it.
What does this say, though? I mean, this is a bit in your territory, too, Scott Schaefer, about the longstanding argument that, well, the polls say Californians are against the death penalty, but it's really the way the poll questions are worded. It's the phrasing, all that sort of thing.
Well, I don't think there have been any polls that have suggested that Californians are against the death penalty. Support for the death penalty has, you know, remained. It's been dropping, but it's, you know, it's been in the 60s. But when you ask people if, you know, when you ask people about the alternative of life in prison without the possibility of parole, that has been gaining support. And as we saw last night, it came close with 47% of the vote, but not quite. And, you know, we are now at the point where, you know, there hasn't been an execution in California since 2006. There are 14 inmates on death row who have exhausted their appeals. And so right now there's still a moratorium from the courts. But if California does again proceed with executions, perhaps with a different protocol than the three-drug protocol that they had been using, you know, we could begin to see some executions. It's been a long time. And, you know, that could change public opinion too.
Well, speaking of things in threes, the three strikes law and the revision of it in Proposition 36 did pass.
It did. And what's interesting for both of these measures is the lack of organized opposition. I mean, Prop 34 failed, but proponents, you know, vastly outraised by something like 7-1, I think, the opponents. And Prop 36 had pretty broad consensus. Steve Cooley, the district attorney in Los Angeles, getting together with George Gascon, you know, kind of the liberal-conservative coalition to get some broad-based support for Prop 36, which easily passed. But in neither case was there the, you know, kind of well-funded, high-profile opposition that we've seen in the past, for example, with the last time three strikes was on the ballot.
And like we saw John Myers in 37, I mean, that was polling really high to pass. I'm talking about the proposition to require labeling of genetically engineered foods, and it went down.
It did, and I think in large part because of the television campaign against it. I mean, the big food companies across the country and the agriculture interests spent a tremendous amount of money on ads, raising a lot of questions about how Prop 37 would have worked, that the labels wouldn't have really told you anything, that there were too many opportunities for frivolous lawsuits, and on and on and on. And, you know, to me, that's another reminder that the television ads work and the campaigns work. And when you can poke a hole in an initiative, the default measure of Californians typically is no.
Let's talk also for a moment, John, about a lot of money that went into different initiatives by individuals. Molly Munger, of course, comes to mind. Her tax increase, Proposition 38, went down to defeat. And there was certainly a lot of money, once again, in the changing of the car insurance rates. Came out of Mercury Insurance head. That was Proposition 33. But Tom Steyer's proposition backing really turned out to be, well, golden for him.
Yeah, a venture capitalist, a hedge fund manager, a former, I should say. He's now left his firm, and we'll see what he does. Some people think he has political interest in the state. But spent more than $20 million of his own money on Prop 39 to change corporate taxes, to close this corporate tax structure that let out-of-state corporations pay less taxes. So it brings in about $1 billion into the state over the first year and subsequently from there. But, yeah, we had, you know, it's fascinating, the history records of rich people in California trying to get the voters to do something are not very good, whether they're
especially
running
when they run for governor. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Governor Checkey, Governor Whitman, et cetera. But Steyer found a way forward here, and I think there was, as Scott talked about, no opposition really in some of those crime and punishment issues. The opposition evaporated on Prop 39. The out-of-state corporations basically said, we're okay with it because they didn't want to be painted as the big, ugly people taking money away from California.
There was also no opposition really to speak of to Proposition 35, which increased penalties for human trafficking. It passed by over 80%, and Chris Kelly put an immense amount of money into that. Does this sort of reignite his career as he lost to Kamala Harris?
Yeah, he was the former privacy officer, chief privacy officer for Facebook, and lost that primary to Harris. Hard to know. You know, the fascinating thing here is what motivates these people who have a lot of money. I mean, switching to a different measure for a moment, as you mentioned, Michael, Molly Munger, the wealthy civil rights attorney behind Prop 38. She put $47 million of her own money into this tax increase for schools and only got about 28% of the vote. We could do the math as to what it cost her per vote. What motivates these people? Does Chris Kelly have political interest? Does Tom Steyer have political interest? Does Charles Munger, Molly Munger's brother, have political interest in trying to kill the governor's tax measure? And some people have said he does, by the way. Who knows what motivates them? Are they motivated by civics or personal things? But the bottom line, I think, if you look at this ballot from yesterday, you got skepticism of the voters. And I think Governor Brown with Prop 30 did a tremendous thing in overcoming the innate skepticism about taxes and state government.
But even on that one, John, Scott Schaefer, you know, there was a criticism of the first TV ad that the Yes on 30 ad campaign rolled out, saying that the Sacramento politicians couldn't get their hands on this money. It was going to go to the schools. And you're right. You know, Jerry Brown, given the lack of trust in government, was able to overcome that and get Prop 30 passed. But there may well be pressure on the legislators to you know, kind of some funny business with the money and you know, use it for other purposes. But obviously, there'll be a lot of people paying close attention to that.
And that does, if I could, Michael, quickly, that does get us back to what you asked me at the beginning here about the makeup of the California legislature as it looks now with this supermajority of Democrats. You know, Prop 30 was a budget Band-Aid. The honest thing is it's a temporary tax. It basically is in place until the economy hopefully recovers in California. But now you've got a new crop of Democrats with a lot of power at the Capitol and a Democratic governor. Will they get along? Will they have differences about how to do everything because they don't have to talk to Republicans? It's going to be fun to watch.
Actually, the horse races are always fun to watch. And before I came behind the microphone this morning, there were a couple that were very close. And, John, you're always up to the moment on these. Do we have results that are final on the 7th District, the Lundgren-Barra race?
We do not. Ami Barra, the Democratic challenger, is up by less than 200 votes when the precinct votes were counted as of last night. We don't have a full answer on how many absentee ballots have not been counted here in Sacramento County. They say they won't know until at best this evening. But we certainly realize there are substantial ones because, as we saw all across California, more people voting by mail and a heck of a lot of those people turning those ballots in at the polling place, and that means that they're not counted until after the election. But Dan Lundgren, if he loses that race, that's a big win for Democrats because Lundgren was a veteran incumbent Republican here, and that district really redrawn in redistricting, and you saw some of that around the state. I mean, you know, pivoting just for a moment, I was just fascinated by the dynamics of this election after these reforms that we, quote-unquote, have put in place. Top two primary, redistricting, both candidates and in the way these ballot measures played, too. It was an interesting election. I think we're going to be reading about this a lot. People like Corey are going to be telling us about it years to come.
Well, we're also going to check in with Corey, particularly about local measures and some of the elections locally. But let me go back to Scott Schaefer, talking about the new Congress here. California is losing a lot of seniority in this new Congress.
They really are. And part of that has to do with the redistricting, and part of it also has to do with the top two primaries, where you had somebody like Howard Berman, who's been in Congress for more than 30 years, losing to Brad Sherman, a Democrat on Democrat, part of that.
Who won the fist fight? Do we know that?
Well, it was broken up, I think, before they came to blows. But Brad Sherman won the election, largely, I think, because he had represented most of that district before it was redrawn. But if you look down the list of incumbent members of Congress who are retiring, starting right here in the Bay Area with Lynn Woolsey, who chose not to run in part, I think, because her district was quite different than
Jared Huffman has been elected.
Jared Huffman,
considerable amount.
Yeah, so it doesn't change hands in terms of the party. Pete Stark, who's been there 40 years, losing to Eric Swalwell, a 31-year-old local city councilman from Dublin. You know, then going up to the Reading area, Wally Herger is retiring. He's been there 26 years. Jerry Lewis down in the Inland Empire, he's been there 34 years. Bob Filner got elected or is leading. It looks like he's going to be elected mayor of San Diego. He's been there 20 years. And there are several others. David Dreyer has been there 32 years. So you've got a lot of seniority. And, of course, places like the House of Representatives run largely by seniority. And so there's a lot of committee chairs. And I think also with the fact that the Republicans are going to maintain control of the House, you're going to see a California delegation perhaps with a lot less clout than it had in the last Congress.
Let's bring Corey Cook into this and let's look a little more locally. We've been talking a lot about the state. And Corey, first of all, in San Francisco, I mean, the supervisorial race is there were some surprises there, particularly with Eric Maher.
I think actually there were quite a few surprises. I think three of the races were somewhat surprising. Eric Maher, you know, appears to have held on to his seat. You know, he was, I think, an embattled incumbent. I think there were a lot of folks thought this would be an incredibly close race. And as of the current counting, I think he's a 16 percentage point lead, which is sizable. I mean, when he was elected, he narrowly won his seat in the first place.
And there was a lot of money that came in from the other side.
Yeah, this is the most expensive supervisorial race in San Francisco history, and a ton of outside money, independent expenditures, I mean, mailings every day, door hangers every day.
District 1, we should mention. And let me just get in here, the fact that we're talking about money in politics. I think the Lundgren-Barra race was the third most wide expenditure in the country.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's just a ton of money in the statewide stuff as well as the local elections. And some of these were, you know, even some of these Democrats on Democrats races, just an incredible amount of money. The Sherman-Berman race in Los Angeles was an incredibly expensive election that wasn't even, you know, impacting party control.
Right,
so,
which is why the party leaders hate it.
Right, right.
So how does it stack up now in San Francisco in terms of the often cited division between progressives and conservatives, which would be, I guess, pretty far to the left in almost any other state?
Right. Well, and this is what's interesting, is that the most progressive district in San Francisco, which is District 5, appears to have elected London Breed, who is regarded as the most moderate of the candidates in that district. She's ahead by 8 or 9 percentage points on first-place tallies. The Department of Election, this is a ranked choice election, so they actually ran the ranked choice tally last night to give you a preliminary count, and she actually picks up votes every round. So she's in pretty good shape, and I think that's an outcome that a lot of people would be surprised by. So to replace, in effect, Ross Mercurimi, you know, London Breed is likely to be the victorious candidate in that race. And then alternatively, District 7, which is considered the most conservative district in San Francisco, appears to have elected a progressive. And so these two districts somewhat appear to have swapped themselves. And so I think we have this largely the same sort of balance we had before, but for very different reasons. And I think people are going to be sorting out what exactly happened in 5, what happened in 7 for a while.
And how much did the Mercurimi debacle, or whatever one wants to call it, affect this election in San Francisco?
I'm not certain. You know, Christina Laghi is running for re-election in District 5. It's a district.
She voted on his side. Yeah.
She voted on his side. She was appointed by the mayor to replace him. She was in a lot. She had a challenge initially because progressives were a little wary of her because she'd been appointed by the mayor and supported by Willie Brown, and so she had difficulty overcoming this. You know, she was an agent of the mayor argument. At the same time, moderates, you know, thought she was too progressive. And so I think she was squeezed for the first year as she was appointed supervisor and pulled in a lot of directions. And I think the Mercurimi thing, she voted with her district. Her district clearly wanted Mercurimi to stick around. So she voted the way her district would want. But I think just the whole, you know, aura of that was harmful to her.
Let me go with you, if we may, over to the East Bay election, Oakland City Council, Berkeley Mayor. How'd they come up?
So Rebecca Kaplan appears to have won and held on
the
challenge. Yeah, Ignacio de la Fuente challenged her for the citywide. There's one citywide city council seat in Oakland. There's going to be a lot of turnover in Oakland. There are going to be 3 new city council members, all in races that are too close where there were vacancies, so open seats. So 3 of the 8 city council members will be new, which is, I think, going to be significant in Oakland.
How's that going to affect Mayor Kwan?
Well, we'll see how the final numbers sort out. But I think, you know, she was at a loggerheads with the city council, so yeah, it certainly can't hurt. But having her closest ally on the board was Rebecca Kaplan. Her biggest opponent was Ignacio de la Fuente. So a lot of attention to this race, and Rebecca Kaplan is sizably ahead right now at the first count. And so I think that's something that the mayor would certainly be happy about.
And the Berkeley mayoral race?
And the Berkeley mayoral race hasn't been close. And I think I'm a little disappointed as somebody who studies ranked choice voting, because we had not only candidates who were endorsing each other, but actually sharing a headquarters together, which we hadn't seen before. And so the 3 candidates who were opposing Tom Bates actually shared headquarters. They ran together. They said, vote for all 3 of us. And it appears that Tom Bates will have won without even a ranked choice election occurring. So those of us who study this are a little disappointed by that.
Can you talk a little bit also, since we're in the East Bay, about the sit-lie and how that came out in the beverage tax in Richmond?
So the sit-lie appears to have passed in Berkeley, which, is it passed in San Francisco? I think, the assumption is that these are progressive areas where these types of measures would be difficult. But it appears to have passed in Berkeley, and the beverage tax in Richmond was resoundingly defeated.
Huge amount of money in that race.
A huge amount of outside money, yeah, and appears to be defeated.
San Francisco ballot measures?
In effect, it was what the city family wanted. I mean, it's this broad notion of the city family, of this consensus around there's a housing trust fund on the ballot, a revision to the city's payroll tax and bond measures. Basically, everything where there was this unity between the mayor and the board of supervisors was passed overwhelmingly. So all of the parks bond passed, the housing trust fund passed, the
city college, Hetch Hetchy went down,
which they were all opposed to. Yeah. So uniformly opposed to, went down overwhelmingly. So it's sort of the mainstream of San Francisco appears to have spoken very loudly in the citywide elections.
Well, you can also speak loudly. And in fact, we welcome your involvement in this program. If you have something that you really want to get off your chest or talk about with respect to yesterday's election locally and statewide, any questions you might have, we welcome your involvement in the program. Our toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to join us and join the conversation. Like to hear from you. Again, 866-733-6786, particularly if you have some strong responses to the election locally or statewide. Our email address is available to you. It's forum@kqed.org. And you can post any questions or comments you have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment, or go to our Facebook page. And you can also, of course, communicate with us through Twitter by going using our Twitter handle, which is @KQED Forum. John Myers, let me go to a couple of responses online and get your responses to the responses. Melissa comments online, I'm relieved that Prop 30 passed. As a single parent with a daughter in the state university system, this was really important to my personal financial well-being. And as a strong supporter of public education, as the most important aspect of a functioning democracy, this is important to me as a citizen. That kind of speaks loudly, it seems to me, to the kind of support that the governor had on this.
I think it also speaks to what, you know, really was the Trump card, I think, in this race. Because, you know, we talked a lot about that the governor struggled, I think, to clarify what the message was. The television ad said, you know, accountability schools. He would go on the stump and say the budget and jobs, and it was a little confusing. But the bottom line here was that the state budget was built in with these automatic spending cuts if Prop 30 failed. And when you looked at the polls and you saw the questions that people were asked, they were very, very concerned. I think 75% in the last field poll said they were worried about those trigger cuts, and they opposed them, those automatic cuts. I think at the end of the day, that's what got the governor over the top, as people said, I don't love the taxes, but I don't want those cuts.
Well, another listener writes about Prop 30. Since it passed, does this victory mean that we will have smaller class sizes and be able to hire more teachers? And also, does this win mean that this money will not be diverted to other programs other than education to balance a budget, which we've kind of alluded to before? John?
I think it's a mixed bag, Michael. I mean, I think that what you saw a number of school districts around the state who made budgets earlier in the spring for this year. They made a budget assuming Prop 30 would fail because they wanted to be conservative. They didn't want to have to cut in the middle of the year. So in those school districts that made those plans, it is a question of mine this morning as I woke up and as I talked to people here in my newsroom, are there school districts that now go, hey, look, you know, we were conservative, now we actually have the money, can we do some things here? But the bottom line is, I do have to point out to the listeners, this is a Band-Aid approach. I mean, this does not bring a lot of new money in the schools. That would have probably been Prop 38. It will bring a little bit new money, but it is a bit of a budget Band-Aid until hoping the economy recovers and some other tax issues are resolved in the state.
Well, we've got you just for seconds left. I know we have to say goodbye to you at the break. John, a lot of responses on 37, people disappointed. One listener says, you know, maybe the voters really looked at the issues and found out there was no scientific justification, and therefore the food money or food company agribusiness money behind it shouldn't have mattered that much. They're talking about already mounting a campaign. I mean, seriously, might we see this on the ballot again?
I think it's possible, but, you know, I think Prop 37 lost for the reason that initiatives have lost all throughout California direct democracy history, and that is someone runs a campaign that says, and I quote, this measure is not what it really says. You know, you've heard that phrase in television and radio ads for years, and that's what the big food industry did. It's not what it really says. It does something that it doesn't really say it's going to do. When you tell the voters that, and if you say it loud enough, and if you do raise that doubt, they, you know, have a default of no. And so I think it'll be interesting. Will these people come back? It's a big issue. People really want to know about genetically modified foods, and you're right, we may not have heard the end of it.
Well, John, good to have you with us. Appreciate very much you being with us. John Myers, again, political editor now with KXTV in Sacramento, former Sacramento Bureau Chief for KQED News, and you can join this program. We're talking about results from yesterday's election, state and local. Again, we welcome your calls at 866-733-6786, and we welcome your emails, forum@kqed.org, or you can post any questions or comments you have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment, or by going to our Facebook page, and you can also tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQED Forum. Corey Cook with us. Scott Schaefer with us. We'll continue. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. California's decided many major issues yesterday and went to the polls and elected, or for that matter, voted down a number of issues and candidates as well. And we're trying to sort it all out here. We have had John Myers with us for the first half hour, political editor now with KXTV in Sacramento and our former Sacramento bureau chief for KQED News. And Corey Cook's here, associate professor of politics and director of the Leo McCarthy Center for Public Service and the Common Good at USF, University of San Francisco. And Scott Schaefer here with us in studio, reporter and host of KQED's The California Report. I want to make one important correction. The sit-lie measure in Berkeley, Corey got the percentage right, but read the wrong part of the whatever. It's 58%, but it went down and was defeated 58%. You may want to join this program with some thoughts about yesterday's election or any questions you might have, and we do welcome your involvement in the program. You can go to our Facebook page and post any questions or comments you have or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or email us, forum@kqed.org. And, of course, you can also call us, and our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, and we're going to go to all your responses here forthwith. Wanted to first bring in the whole question of, well, gay marriage and that possibly being back on the ballot, same-sex marriage. Scott Schaefer, I mean, we're seeing certainly in other states. Yesterday we talked about it in the last hour when we covered national issues in Washington and Maryland and Maine. And Governor Schwarzenegger had vetoed it twice. Come back, do you think?
Well, it could with a supermajority. As you said, the legislature did pass twice a gay marriage bill that was vetoed, and now with a supermajority. Now, whether that'll be the first thing they want to do when they get in there with their new authority is to pass gay marriage, I don't know. But you can be sure Mark Leno is thinking about it. Jerry Brown supports same-sex marriage. And so we also, before then, in fact, as soon as a couple of weeks, we're going to know whether or not the U.S. Supreme Court is going to take up Proposition 8. They may not take that up, in which case gay marriage will become legal via the courts. So we'll know about that before we know about what happens in the legislature.
And before I go to my callers here, Jim and Martinez writes, I'm curious to get your response to this, Scott. He says, as a former proponent of the death penalty, now an opponent of it, when can we expect executions to restart? Can we ever reduce the number of appeals and lawyers who are involved in this process? Should we? I don't wish to see innocent people executed, nor do I wish to see those properly convicted languish indefinitely in jails, such as the killer of Polly Klass.
Yeah. Well, as I said earlier, there are 14 people on death row who have exhausted their legal appeal. So if executions do begin once again, if the court moratorium is lifted, then, you know, conceivably we could see those. But, you know, the truth is the legislature, which could expedite the appeals process, doesn't want to. I mean, California does not execute many people, and there's a lot of support for things the way they are and not very little interest. I mean, Jerry Brown yesterday acknowledged that he voted for Prop 34. Many suspected, you know, he's been a longtime opponent of the death penalty, so I don't think you're going to see him. He's also canceled plans to build a new death row at San Quentin, citing budgetary reasons. But, you know, I don't think you're going to see an impetus for more executions in California. It's just that if they do begin, there are now several, I hate to use this phrase, but in the pipeline, you know, that are teed up and ready to go if they begin.
Although you may have seen a gentleman who was convicted of, I use the word a gentleman advisedly, of two murders recently and given the death penalty, said, hey, you know, nobody's executed in this state. I'll just hang around in the prison and spend my time there, and that'll be my crib, and, you know, I'll just be there probably for the rest of my life. I mean, it was very cynical, but you can understand where he would say things.
Well, there was an interesting article in the Chronicle a few weeks ago. Bob Agelko, the legal reporter there, talked with folks on death row, and they opposed Prop 34, many of them, because they claim they're innocent, you know, and if they want to have that legal appeal and that opportunity to prove once and for all that they didn't do it, you know.
It was also fascinating when we covered it because, I mean, we covered all 11 propositions, and when we covered 34, we had the former warden of San Quentin in with us, and she was essentially presenting it, and they were all presenting it as cost savings, and they had the data that said this will save costs, but it still didn't go. Well, anyway, let me go to our callers. And David, we begin with you. You're on, David. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wondered if your guest could comment on the possible national significance of Prop 30. As you know, in 1978, Prop 13 was passed, and that inaugurated a kind of celebration of tax cuts and reduction of revenues. And it seems to me as though Prop 30 reflects voters' recognition again that there's a connection between the taxes they pay and the government services that are provided. And it's possible that recognition may spread more widely beyond California. And I wonder if your guest comment on that, and I'll take the answer off off the air. Thanks.
Okay, we thank you for the call. Corey Cook.
I don't think it's particularly likely, and the reason is I think what Jerry Brown did with this measure, and John mentioned this earlier, was tying directly the trigger cuts to the tax increases, force voters to link the spending cuts that were occurring at the state level to the lack of revenue. Most of the time, these things are on the ballot, or they're approached by voters. They're approached as if they're approached as different issues. That there's the what should we spend money on, as separate from is there money to be spent. And as a result, I think you have. I think California is still very much an anti-tax state. I think had this measure not been designed in this manner, it would not have passed. And it very much was the particularity of California and where we are currently.
Well, and also California makes it extraordinarily difficult to raise taxes, through the legislature. And so I don't think other states would necessarily need to resort to going to the ballot for a general tax increase the way California does.
Yeah, but the national discourse is still dominated, I think, by the arguments we heard in the presidential debates, for example, that you can have tax cuts that will pay for themselves as the economy grows. But this linkage between tax increases and the need for services, that there's actual relationship between how much money the government brings in and what it spends in programs, that's something that I don't think has been made for voters, and I don't even think it was made for California voters, with the exception of it through this particular measure.
One other point quickly, Michael, about Prop 30. There was an email you had earlier from a woman, I think, whose daughter was in university, UC Berkeley or something. One of the reasons some people were not excited about Prop 30 is that there is no guarantee that tuition isn't going to go up. It won't go up in this year, in this school year, but it may well go up next year. And one of the people who was, I think, interestingly absent from the Prop 30 campaign was Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. And he was not out there at all for Prop 30. I don't think Jerry Brown asked him to do anything.
I think he was distinguishing himself from Prop 30.
Well, and I wouldn't be surprised if, he wouldn't have been heartbroken if it failed, in part because, he and Jerry Brown do not get along. They do not have a relationship. Clearly, Gavin Newsom is bored being lieutenant governor and would like to do something else. And, a little bit of speculation there on my part, but I do think that, neither one of them will be invited to the same, they're not going to be invited to the same Thanksgiving dinner, that's for sure.
Let me bring Scott on. Scott, join us. I think you're on point here. Good morning.
Hey, Michael, thanks for taking my call. Related to Prop 30, how far does it go in solving the budget and debt issues with the state? I've heard a couple of your panelists note that it's a Band-Aid solution and tuition might go up. What kind of pain does this take away, and what can we anticipate over the next number of years with the passage of this resolution?
Corey Cook.
So, in this current budget year, it takes away a lot of pain because we're talking about direct cuts that were going to occur in K-12, higher ed, and some public service, public safety programs. So it does patch a $6 billion hole in this current budget. It does generate that revenue in future years. So it really depends on how the economy is growing. $6 billion is roughly the size of the structural budget deficit. So for 4 years, it could actually get us to even. But if it's the next few years are like the past few, you're talking about $12 to $15 billion in cuts every year, where this is a small Band-Aid. It doesn't even sufficiently cover the damage.
And it does nothing to solve problems like pension costs, either at the state or local levels. And now that it looks like the Democrats are going to have a supermajority, there's going to be all kinds of pressure to do things that Jerry Brown may not want to do, either in terms of additional new revenue or, enhancing spending, maybe trying to use some of that money from Prop 30 for things other than schools. So I think it's going to be very interesting to see how Jerry Brown positions himself. He didn't particularly get along with the Democratic legislature when he was governor the first time. And he was known as being, not a big spender at all. Small is beautiful, that kind of thing. And it will be an interesting struggle to see just exactly what he signs, what he vetoes, and whether they can override his vetoes now if they choose to.
Well, also, speaking of pension reform, I think Chuck Reed, the mayor of San Jose, was given kind of a imprimatur by the election, wouldn't you say, Corey Cook?
Yeah, I think so. Obviously, he's one of the leaders statewide on pension reform. And, I agree with Scott that this is there are some looming fiscal problems in California that aren't even being accounted for in the current budget.
Which candidates that he backed, though,
yes,
this election came through. So that was what I was
– Yeah, exactly right.
Autumn writes, I'm horrified that 35 passed. Now, we haven't even talked about 35,
human
which was human trafficking. No one wants to sound soft on sex traffickers, so people voted for this. But dramatically expanding the sex offender law is a bad deal for California for many reasons. Also, as a tech worker, the loss of digital privacy for anyone bothers me a great deal. This was a difficult law to oppose because the bad guys in it are despicable. But it will criminalize a large swath of people who have nothing in common with rapists and child molesters, and I am quite unhappy at its passing.
Well, you know, it's California, with its extremely powerful initiative direct democracy system, you know, you end up with unintended consequences sometimes. We've seen that with other laws that have passed. Some would say Prop 13, you know, had all kinds of unintended consequences. Originally, it was to help homeowners, especially seniors who were, you know, at risk of, you know, not being able to pay their property taxes. So that's one that, you know, could well have some of those ramifications. And, of course, under this system, the legislature can't fix it. It has to go back to the voters. If there is something either with Prop 35 or anything else that the voters pass, the voters have to change it.
A lot of emails, as you would expect, about the supermajority. Melissa says, supermajority is such an amazingly welcome surprise. Now that it's here, let's fix things. Get the two-thirds rule change and get taxes increased in a fair way. And Herb says, Democratic supermajority, can the onerous parts of Prop 13 be fixed without a ballot vote? I mean, people are looking for all kinds of fixes here.
I think the answer to that is no. But, you know, what could happen, it's just interesting to think through, like, what could the Democrats do with a two-thirds majority? And, you know, looking at the direct democracy system in California, there are some things that could be done to tweak it, not get rid of it. They'll never do that. Voters would never go for that. But the legislature could do things, for example, have an automatic sunset after 5 years, or some kind of an opportunity for the legislature to adopt the gist of a ballot measure before it goes to the voters. I mean, there are all kinds of things that other states do that, you know, kind of moderate the power of the ballot. And, you know, especially this year, and it's not new, but all the money that goes in, sometimes somebody with a you know, has a lot of money just champions one particular ballot measure. People may feel that it is time to revise that. The legislature could also look at some revisions to campaign finance disclosure, for example. We saw at the end there that $11 million contribution to the Yes on 32 campaign. So that's something the legislature could – they could really, you know, decide – to go for some good government kinds of changes at the state legislature to make California work a little better than it does right now.
And again, Scott Schaefer, reporter and host of KQED's The California Report. And let's go to Jane in Corte Madera. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm just curious to know, now that we have reinstated the death penalty, let me clear my throat, I'm sorry, which, you, as you well know, Michael, I've been working to on getting rid of it.
Yeah, but it wasn't reinstated. It was there, and it's still there.
Yes, it's still there. But my question is now: are we going to look to build that new death row, which the governor vetoed because when he came into office because it was so expensive?
Scott is shaking his head no.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to be a spending priority for the governor. I mean, he, you know, as we said, he voted to abolish the death penalty. You know, the leading cause of death on death row is old age and suicide. And I think that's probably going to continue in the foreseeable future. And I just don't think Jerry Brown is going to want to sink a lot of money into that at a time when schools are struggling and social service programs have been cut. And, you know, so I don't think it's going to happen.
I just wanted to mention we pretty much covered so many of the issues on the ballot, not only statewide but locally. And we did cover the Oakland Zoo parcel tax, and that passed by over 60%. It was interesting how strong the response was. And there are strong responses, particularly, I'm just looking at emails here again on 37 going down. This is a listener who says, I was surprised and disappointed 37 failed. Our public health is a concern to me, and our food system is the foundation for America's health crisis. We do not yet know the long-term health effects of GMOs. Should not even be a vote for them to be labeled. But then Red from Oakland says, many undecided voters probably looked into the issue of labeling GMOs, saw no scientific justification, and voted with their common sense. Money is important, but saying it is everything minimizes the thoughtful process of many, many voters. And you see the split right there in terms of those two emails. We've been talking about most of the state propositions, but didn't talk about we didn't touch on 39, which would increase taxes for multi-state businesses and fund clean energy and energy-efficient initiatives, or actually Proposition 40, which approves the current state Senate district boundaries, those were both voted in, and those will both have changes, Corey Cook, big changes.
Well, at 39 in particular, I mean, I think if you look at the map on 39, it's pretty remarkable. 39 passed in the Inland Empire, it passed in Orange County. I mean, it passed with 60% of the vote. It looks a lot like the Obama vote, frankly, in 2008 in California. They really swept essentially all but the small counties. And to see a tax increase, and particularly a targeted one that was being, you know, there was some criticism that some half of the funds would go to, you know, funding, you know, various greening programs, greening public buildings, job training around green technology, et cetera. There was some complaint about, you know, should be spending money on that. This was a huge victory for Tom Steyer and the SN39 folks.
And Scott, I'd like you actually, if you would, to talk about 31 more. I mean, what this means, the revision of state budget prices, which went down over 60%.
Yeah, that I was going to say, that was a very complicated ballot measure. It was framed as a good government kind of revisions, giving the governor sort of unilateral authority to cut the budget if it got into deficit, and giving local government the opportunity to get around state regulations if they felt that they could do, you know, implement sort of the same goals on their own. And there was a lot of concern from environmentalists and others that that could be used to get around environmental regulations. And it was just, I think, too complicated. It's a classic case of people looking at it on the ballot and saying, I don't know what this means. I'm voting no. And it failed 61 to 39. You know, it was put forward by this good government group, the Think Long Committee and California Forward. But I think they just tried to do too much in one ballot measure, and people just said no.
And speaking of no, there's somebody again who supports the opposition to Prop 37 and writes, Michael, you mentioned the ads opposing it and the money from large agribusiness, which may have led to its defeat. However, you didn't mention the fact that both the San Francisco Chronicle and the LA Times were also opposed to it due to the details of how it would be enforced through personal lawsuits and the onus placed on retailers to make sure labeling happens. I don't think there's any doubt that the majority of Californians want GMO labeling, but does your panel think this proposal was the best way to go about it? Well, there were also all those exemptions that certainly didn't help the passing of this proposal. But it gets to the core of the question that I often raise whenever we talk about these initiatives. You get enough signatures, you get a short window, and you put something on the ballot, and it's not necessarily very well written, and there are lots of loopholes and lots of lawsuits in the making. I mean, the problem, to many respects, goes back to the legislature not doing what they should be doing. They're not being able to do it.
Yeah. And the reality is that I don't remember the exact numbers, but most things that are on the ballot fail in California, because it's really easy to mount a serious campaign against something if you can poke enough holes in it, raise enough doubts in it. And certainly when you spend $45 million or whatever it is that the opponents of Prop 37 spent, you know, you have a pretty good chance to shoot it down.
And here's a caller from Petaluma. Ferdinand, join us. Hi.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
I just wanted to mention, and I guess I'm extremely dismayed that Proposition 30 passed. You know, it seems like the state always uses cuts in education as a threat that, you know, if they don't pass something or if we don't pass something. And, you know, if you go back to the state lottery, which was passed, voters passed because, you know, they purported to, they were going to spend the money on education. You know, that didn't happen. And it seems like they always come back and, like, we're going to spend the money on education. And people pass it, and the money goes into the general fund, and it gets, you know, wasted, in, you know, my opinion. But, you know, how is it that people are, I mean, are people just ignorant or gullible or don't remember what happened in the past? Because we should have plenty of money for education, shouldn't we?
You know, Michael, before the campaign, we did a series, participated with the Public Policy Institute of California, focus groups with voters around the state. And we went to the Inland Empire, and we went to Los Angeles, Fresno. And every time we heard this same issue, what happened to the lottery money? People feel that when they voted for the lottery, that that was going to fix the schools. Well, there is money from the lottery going to the schools. It isn't very much. And it never was, but that's how that campaign passed, and that's what they used to convince voters. And it was never a panacea, but people feel that it should have been enough money, or that it, you know, why do we need more money? You know, why isn't that working?
But the same lesson doesn't apply to 30. I mean, if you do the campaign with the lottery and say, save the schools, vote for the lottery, and it winds up not saving the schools, this campaign has, in effect, kind of saved the schools, at least from...
Well, it'll certainly save the schools, as Corey said, from $5.3 to $6 billion in cuts in this budget year.
Yeah.
But there are still, you know, a lot of problems facing the schools and school funding there. And also, we've had cuts in past years. The other thing I wanted to say is, you know, why are the cuts coming out of education? Well, because Prop 98, which voters passed, you know, in 1988 or whatever it was, mandates that about half of the state budget be dedicated to education.
Yeah.
So, you know, you got to, as Willie Sutton used to say, you got to, why do you rob
banks?
You go where the money is.
Actually, well, you
got to cut education.
Willie, there's a new biography of Willie Sutton. He never actually said that. It was one of those things that just, you know, became common currency like things do on the internet now. But
as Herb Cain said, never let the facts get in the way of a good story, Michael.
Carl writes, Corey, in Oakland, one of the biggest issues is the power of the Oakland Police Officers Association. However, in this election, at least two of Police Officers Association's allies went down, Ignacio de la Fuente, City Council, and Jane Brenner, City Attorney. This is good news, writes Carl. I suppose from his perspective, it makes a big difference, though.
It does. If I could just quickly also go back to one of the caller's earlier points about the supermajority and could the state legislature change that, just to briefly run down the heightened requirement for local revenue measures. So if you look around the Bay Area, basically all the revenue measures that were 50% thresholds, just about all of them passed. 16 of the 18 bond measures passed. All of the transaction use taxes that were 50% passed. When you get the higher thresholds, then it's 50% pass and 50% don't. And so if you look around the Bay Area, people are willing to tax themselves more, but a lot of these measures that, you know, got 50%, but they didn't get the two-thirds requirement. So the Oakland Zoo got 62%. It's a two-thirds requirement for a parcel tax. So while it's a high, you know, it's a majority of voters voting for that, a lot of places these things are going down by not hitting these higher thresholds.
You know, there were also a lot of, I think more than 200 local school tax increases. And there was a lot of concern that people would vote for those, but not Prop 30. I don't know. I haven't looked at the results of all those local elections, but apparently
in the Bay Area, they didn't affect it. But again, broader in California, I don't know.
Yeah. I got another local question here. San Francisco supervisors race. Tim joins us. Hi, Tim.
Yeah, hi. Thank you so much. I was wondering, I'm a big Julian Davis supporter, and I was wondering how District 5 turned out.
I don't think those results are definitive yet. In fact, Breed is leading 28%, Lage 20%. But what do we know on this, Corey Cook?
So what I appreciate, the this is a ranked choice election. The county this time ran the ranked choice results based on these early votes. So there's still votes left to be counted, but we have a pretty good sense of how it's turning out. And not only does London Breed lead after first place votes, her lead increases after each round, which is what we typically see from those who win. Now, it's certainly possible that the next round of ballots that are counted will be fundamentally different than these other ones. But she's in pretty good shape if you're looking, you know, at the ranked choice results. She actually does very, very well. Progressives seem to have not fully supported Olagi. And so when the progressives who start to lose and their ballots are redistributed to other candidates, a lot of those votes are not going to Christina Olagi, as I think people had anticipated. Typically, incumbents will get a big chunk of those, and for whatever reason, she hasn't.
How much was Davis affected by, well, what amounted to a kind of groping scandal, or I don't know how to characterize it. That's really what it was.
He was profoundly affected. I mean, he had the loss of endorsements, John Avalos and others, the Bay Guardian pulled their endorsements from him. That critically wounded his campaign, and I think had a big impact on what we're seeing right now.
And Olagi was hurt by her vote on Mercurimi, clearly, wasn't she?
I think she was hurt from the time that she was appointed in a very progressive district. I think she had some distance. You know, her relationship with the mayor. She actually got embroiled in the controversy over Ross Mercurimi because, you know, there's these issues about what did the mayor say and when he testified in a conversation he may have had with the supervisor. I think she had a lot of challenges on all ends as a result of that whole case.
Bring a caller in. Harriet, you got a mailer that was deceptive? Who ever heard of such a thing?
Huh? Yes, it was a picture of Dianne Feinstein and Barack Obama and an eagle. And then on the back, there was a picture of a young girl reading a book. And then on the page of the proposition, there was a yes on 30, yes on A1, all the nice Democratic propositions. And then a big no on 37, stop the deceptive food labeling scheme. And a lot of people use these voter guides, and I'm sure that many people voted no on 37 because of this guide, because it was sent all over the state.
Well, let's talk about guides that were perhaps somewhat deceptive, Scott?
Well, you know, the reality is that you can pay for a Slate mailer that looks somewhat official, and it's really just paid for by a particular campaign. In that case, it was probably the No on 37 campaign, and they're pretty smart. You know, they know how to fool voters and how to get people to go in their direction. I would put in a post-election plug for KQED's proposition guide, which was very, very popular, and our online team did a great job trying to just strip away all the hype and just give the facts and let people decide for themselves.
It's enormously helpful to so many people. I'm very proud of it. I got to go on record here. I've said this before, I suppose. What has always disturbed me in these elections is the unwillingness often of incumbents to even engage in debates. I'm thinking of Senator Feinstein, for example. I mean, it was probably no advantage in her even sitting down or having a debate with her opponent, and she won handily, as everyone expected she would. But it's always disturbed me. I mean, you know, as a host, wanting to get people engaged in debates as part of the political process just often doesn't happen because incumbents feel, what do I have to gain by it?
Well, I think the governor as well has been very difficult to get in many cases, and that was true
not for Candy Crowley, but for yeah, local people.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's true of Feinstein too. She loves talking to CNN. But no, I think politicians have figured out that they can control their message a lot more than they used to. And we've even seen, you know, in an extreme, the White House in some cases demanding approval of quotes from administration officials who talk to newspapers and others. And, you know, there's a pushback now from the media about that. But, you know, you can't force a politician to debate and you can't, you know, force anyone to give you an interview. You know, it's just the way it is. They'll do what they think is in their best interest.
Well, as we come to the conclusion of this hour, any thoughts from either of you about the turnout yesterday? I mean, locally or statewide? Corey?
I mean, it appears to be sort of in between the 2010 and 2012. I think what we saw nationally was this incredible Democratic turnout machine, which appears to have had a profound impact in these swing states as well as these really close Senate races. We didn't see the same degree of turnout in California, but certainly a more diverse and more robust electorate than we saw 2 years ago.
And I think also the candidates were very diverse. We didn't talk much about these races, but down in the Inland Empire, it looks like Mary Bono Mack, the longtime Republican, may be losing to Raul Ruiz, a doctor down there. Mark Takano, an openly gay Japanese-American candidate. It looks like he's going to win the 41st Congressional District in Riverside. Ami Berra leading Dan Lundgren narrowly. But, you know, and even Ricky Gill, who lost to Jerry McNerney, a young up-and-coming Republican. So another one, Jose Hernandez, son of immigrants, farm workers in the Central Valley. A lot of folks sort of reflecting the diversity of California, not just in the electorate, but those who are on the ballot as well.
Well, we've covered a lot of territory. Thanks to both of you, and thanks also to John Myers, who was with us earlier. Corey Cook, again, is at USF, Associate Professor of Politics, and Scott Schaefer is reporter and host of KQED's The California Report. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is today, Paul Lancour, and thank you for being with us. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.